Hi there. This is Eric Detweiler, a PhD candidate at the University of Texas at Austin and assistant director in the DWRL. Every year, the lab holds a speaker series event, inviting scholars from across the country to present research that sits at the intersections of rhetoric, writing, and digital technology. In past years, the DWRL's hosted Cynthia Self, Victor Vitanza, DJ Spooky, Jody Shipka, Cynthia Haynes, and Gregory Ulmer. In 2015, we had the pleasure of having Dr. Colin Brook, associate professor of rhetoric and writing at Syracuse University, director of electronic resources for the Rhetoric Society of America, and the author of the book Lingua Fracta, Towards a Rhetoric of New Media. Dr. Brook's talk at the DWRL was entitled Entropics of Discourse, Post-Human Rhetorics Amidst the Networks. In that talk, part of an in-progress book project entitled Retworks, he traced connections between the so-called master tropes, network studies, and the concept of entropy. I sat down with him before the talk to discuss these concepts and connections, as well as the particular challenges of choosing the medium or media in which digital rhetorical work gets published. In addition to his larger projects, by the way, Dr. Brook is also the curator of RETSI, a weekly collection of, quote, rhetorical miscellany, which you can subscribe to at tinyletter.com/RETSI. That's R-H-E-T-S-Y. And so here we go, an interview with Dr. Colin Brook. This is Eric Detweiler, and I'm talking today with Colin Brook. Colin, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down.
You betcha.
So I wanted to start off by talking about the master tropes, which are one of the concepts you talk about in your talk. And those master tropes are metonymy, metaphor, synecdoche, and irony, which people in rhetoric often associate with the 20th century rhetorician Kenneth Burke. In your talk, though, you trace a slightly longer genealogy of these tropes, going back to Peter Ramus, a 16th century thinker who's well known for his disgust for rhetoric. So I was wondering if you could talk us through that genealogy a little bit and maybe give us a quick gloss also of what makes these tropes, quote-unquote, master.
Yeah. The master tropes, to me, are a really interesting sort of designation. Other than Burke, I think the people who sort of have had the biggest impact on the conversation have been people who are only maybe tangential to rhetorical studies. So, I mean, Ramus, but then also Vico in the 18th century, and then Foucault and Hayden White in the 20th century. You know, I think a sort of a capacious definition of rhetoric includes all of them, but I don't think they get picked up a lot in, say, rhetoric core courses. But so what makes those tropes master, for Ramus at least, was in his book, Arguments in Rhetoric Against Quintilian. He looks at all of the tropes that Quintilian has laid out and says, well, no, all of these are actually figures of speech, except for four of them. And he doesn't actually call them the master tropes. He just says there are only four tropes. And for him, a trope is something that not only is a change in expression, but also changes the meaning. So he identifies those four tropes as actually the only tropes that exist. And then they get kind of taken up and described as the master tropes later on. I'm not sure where they actually acquire that word. With Vico, when he's writing in his New Science in the 18th century, he's the one who treats the tropes as sort of these stages of development within a given civilization. So he talks about metaphor is the age of gods, metonymy is the age of heroes, synecdoche is the age of man or humans, and then irony is kind of the age of barbarism that involves a reboot of the cycle. So I guess that's probably where they get, maybe not called master, but they sort of become master, in the sense that they become this kind of structuring principle for looking at the development of a civilization. With Foucault in the 20th century, in the order of things, it gets turned into this really long, deep structural history of, like, almost human thought. Because Foucault starts with the Renaissance, works to the present day, and that's only one sort of episode of this long cycle. And we haven't even reached the end of it for Foucault. At the time he was writing, he still considered them sort of at the, maybe the tail end of the modern era. But so Renaissance, classical, modern, and then he doesn't really name the fourth. And I guess, I mean, that's a very quick history. And what happens is these ideas just kind of get repeated over and over to the point that by the time Burke's writing in the mid-20th century, these are the master tropes. But it's not like, I don't think it's something that gets really applied in the field very frequently. It's just this kind of, I don't know, this idea that's kind of tangential, that is a way of thinking about some of the tropes, and they become a little bit more familiar to us, but I don't know that anyone's actually sort of taken up and sort of engaged with the tropes as a model, the way that some of these thinkers have.
Hmm. Well, we'll sort of wrap back around to the question of the entropics of discourse in a minute, which is the title of your talk. But you'd mentioned Hayden White briefly in your answer to that last question, and you riff a little bit on his tropics of discourse. Or I don't know if he'd pronounce it tropics or tropics.
I think tropics. So, but I often accidentally pronounce it tropics, so either one.
So we'll say tropics of discourse. So could you talk just briefly about Hayden White's Tropics of Discourse, given its specific relevance to the title of your talk?
Yeah. White is really the one who, I mean, Foucault talks about his methods more in Archaeology of Knowledge than he does in Order of Things. I mean, he mentions the tropes, but he's never really kind of self-conscious about his application. And Burke takes them and sort of translates them into his own terminology. White is really the one who, like, makes explicit the model that they're both using. And Tropics of Discourse is the name of a collection of essays where he talks about Foucault, he talks about a couple different things sort of related to this idea of the tropes as this cycle of development. And then he applies them himself in his book Metahistory. So I take sort of the phrase Tropics of Discourse to kind of be the name of this progressive model of development. And I think White is the person who sort of like names it. And also in some ways is the most kind of self-conscious of it as a particular sort of theoretical move or maneuver. So, I mean, for me, White is kind of the, I don't know, the synthesis of the other stuff. He kind of reattaches Foucault and Burke to Vico and might actually even be the best place to sort of start in terms of thinking about this stuff. So,
cool. Well, in addition to the master tropes, another kind of key concept that you're drawing on in your talk is network. And you mentioned that network is a concept that's gotten a lot of attention in rhetorical studies recently, but you mentioned that the concept often gets thrown around very generically. It made me think of the ways that networks are often discussed in a sort of utopian way, as if they're sort of inherently egalitarian or anarchic. But you question these sort of generic conceptions of networks and instead break down quite a few subcategories. You focus particularly on the distinction between scaled and scale-free networks. And I was wondering if you could unpack that distinction a little bit, maybe talk about why you think it's important to add this sort of nuance to the way we talk about network as a concept.
Sure. I generally work with Duncan Watts' definition of networks, which is, and I don't have it right in front of me, but it's, he describes networks as, or a network as a collection of objects connected to each other in some fashion. I mean, it's a really simple, plain English kind of definition.
Yeah.
And really, it's just, you know, it's stuff connected together. And that's such a generic definition. It encompasses a lot. A lot of times, people who are, say, talking about power laws or like the 80-20 principle are talking about a specific brand of network, a scale-free brand of network that is very different from other kinds of networks. So, I mean, in the sense that, you know, a neighborhood is a network, a company is a network, an academic department is a network. But each of those networks behaves in different ways, has a different topology, and maybe different behaviors that are sort of conditioned by its topology. Scale-free networks are what are the so-called sort of small world networks. So they're networks where everyone in the network is connected to every other sort of node by a smaller number of sort of steps than you would think. So there's the old game, The 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, where, like, you can connect any actor in Hollywood to any other through Kevin Bacon, like in, I don't know, 3 or 4 steps. And it's that notion of, at the same time, this kind of big network that requires very few steps to traverse because of particular sort of hubs of activity. So the fact that Kevin Bacon's been in a lot of movies makes him able to connect a lot of a really diverse set of actors. And I'm kind of like bouncing around your question a little bit, but one of the things that's interesting to me is that scale-free networks are often sort of presented as these, like you say, these kind of anarchic spaces, when in fact, one of the things we find with them is that actually that's scale-free networks generate a lot of asymmetry. In other words, within a scale-free network, there are 1 or 2 like supernodes that have tons of connections, and all the rest of the nodes have very few. And so the actual sort of relative importance of the hubs with the spokes is more asymmetrical, it's more uneven, it's more unfair, you know, than more sort of orderly kind of designed networks, which is kind of the opposite of democracy. I mean, if you're looking at like a social network where different things go viral, things don't go viral because they're the most important things. They happen to just catch on at a moment. And that may not be, well, virality isn't fair. I mean, the whole white and gold, black and blue dress thing, you know.
This was a picture of a dress that was circulating on social media, especially Twitter, where it seemed like about half of the people who saw this picture saw the dress as white and gold, and the other half saw it as black and blue. And there was a lot of, you know, back and forth about the sort of order of the universe that came up as a result of this dress.
I mean, in the grand scheme of things, like, more people were talking about that dress than have perhaps talked about, you know, anything in the last couple of months. Was that because this was a really important event in the development of American culture? No. And that kind of radical asymmetry is one of the things that scale-free networks sort of generate and make possible. You know, and sometimes that can be used, I would say, in good ways. So one of my examples today, too, was the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, which raised more money over the course of a month for ALS research than it happened in, like, the previous 2 years. So they figured out a way to sort of piggyback onto the asymmetry of that scale-free network and raise money that will have a lasting impact. But that notion of adjusting the scale of a phenomenon or adjusting its entropy is part of what I was after in my talk today.
You mentioned entropy at the end of your answer to the previous question, and I want to quote from the statement that you ended your talk today with. You said, quote, "I think I'm running out of time today, so I simply want to close with the final point that this mix of network behavior and tropic modalities can open up concepts like scale and entropy to rhetorical inquiry," unquote. And since we have a little extra time here, I thought I'd ask if you could elaborate on that point, and you can feel free to unpack entropy a little bit if you'd like to, or focus on other terms in that statement.
I think one of the things, and I'm still like working through these ideas, so if I say something that sounds completely foolish, that's just where I'm at the moment. But I think, to me, thinking about these, distinguishing amongst the different types of networks and seeing them behave in particular ways give us a way of articulating and thinking about, on the one hand, scale, which is kind of the tendency in a given network for an individual node to reflect the entire system. And I mean, and Kenneth Burke calls this identification. I mean, identification and synecdoche are very connected for him. Part of how we identify ourselves as humans is by, you know, identifying with the different organizations that we're in, the different sort of affiliations that we're part of. And so a network's scale, part of how it becomes sort of stable and persistent is by not only sort of developing order, but making sure that the individual nodes sort of contribute to that order and reflect that order. For me, entropy is kind of the opposite force. We tend to treat it as negative in terms of just decay, but really entropy is, I describe it as kind of the capacity of a system for change. So, you know, a puff of smoke is a high entropy system. At any moment, it can just like vanish. You know, as opposed to, say, a brick wall, which is very high order, low entropy. So I don't, when I talk about things that go viral, the emergence and the disappearance are both sort of characteristic behaviors of high entropy. So something can appear, spread across social media like wildfire, and then vanish. And to me, that's all sort of entropic behavior. And what I'm suggesting is that there are particular kinds of networks that are more high entropy, low scale, low order, that encourage, you know, viral phenomena that change more rapidly and are actually designed to change more rapidly. And that's actually sort of that's one of the ways that rhetoric functions in these networks, is by resisting or reinforcing order and change. I mean, it sounds really simple when I say it like that. I think it's an interesting, to me, entropy is an interesting sort of perspective on and a way in for rhetoric in terms of, you know, sort of thinking through networks. Like, my bumper sticker version of this is that, for me, one of the outcomes, one of the preferred outcomes of humanist rhetoric is the generation of scale, synecdoche. The Catherine Tumber quote that I used describes the sort of pondering the relationship between part and whole as a particularly humanist disposition. You know, and so Enterby gives us an angle for thinking about the relationships among sort of humanist and post-humanist rhetorics, I think.
Hmm. Nice. Well, I want to finish up by turning in a slightly different direction, shifting emphasis from sort of the content of your talk to the structure of the sort of book project that this talk is a part of. For a lot of scholars in digital rhetoric, I think squeezing their work into the somewhat old-fashioned or maybe just well-established, let's say, format of the book can feel a little constraining. And given that your talk is part of a book project, I was wondering, first of all, if you had any alternate formats in which you considered publishing this project at any point. And second, if you have any plans for letting the sort of network logics you're studying and talking about influence the structure of the book.
The short answer is yes. I mean, in my mind, for probably a good year, year and a half, I sort of had it in my head that I was going to publish this as an app rather than a book. And that may still happen. It's going to depend on how flexible the press wants to be, and also depend on, you know, sort of the resources I have available to me. As I've begun to sort of develop a stronger set of claims that rely upon kind of a longer setup, you know, history of the master tropes, combine that with network studies, what does that synthesis generate? The more scale that I introduce into my project, the more it feels like a book is the right place to house it. Which isn't to say that I don't also imagine versions of the project that would be more amenable to other genres. But I feel like right now, and maybe one of the things that sort of lets it not feel constraining to me is that I'm sort of choosing this particular genre in a way that maybe 5 years ago I wouldn't have been able to. I think as these other genres kind of make themselves more available to us, it adds an extra layer of thinking for me about the project, you know, and thinking about sort of which genre it matches up with best. I think it's nice that we don't have to just automatically assume, you know, book or essay. But the whole point of having those other options is that sometimes the project that you're going to do is going to match better with the idea of a print essay or a book. And right now, it feels like book is the best place, but that may change too. We'll see.
Okay. Well, Colin Brook, I know I'll look forward to the book or app or sculpture or series of performance art pieces. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That's it for this special summer episode of Zoopla. Check back soon for one more episode featuring an interview with Dr. Jody Shipka, associate professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of the book Toward a Composition Made Whole. In the meantime, you can revisit our 2014 summer interview series recorded at the Rhetoric Society of America Conference in San Antonio, Texas. That series features Drs. Roxanne Mountford, Jeff Rice, Joyce Locke Carter, Victor Batanza, and, wouldn't you know it, Colin Brook. You can find those interviews at zeugma.dwrl.utexas.edu/summer2014. That's zeugma.dwrl.utexas.edu/summer2014. We're also in the process of transcribing those interviews. The transcripts, when they're ready, will be accessible via that same link. Thanks for listening. This is Eric Detweiler, signing off.